This is an interview with Gerald Cohn on December 5th, 1995. The interviewer is Jeanette Schreiber. Let's begin with your father and how he happened to come to the Northwest and where he came from.
Yeah, my father, his Russian name was Zamakovsky, Samuel Shmuel Zamakovsky. He was born in about 1880, we think 1880, give or take a little bit, it was 1880, in the town of Belz, B-E-L-D-Z, Belz, which was in Bessarabia. Bessarabia originally, or going back quite a number of years, had been Romania. Later it was taken over by Russia. The native language, the people there spoke Romanian. Later, of course, they had to speak Russian when it was taken over by Russia. Therefore, my father spoke both. But yet, actually, Yiddish was his native language. All the Jewish people spoke Yiddish. He lived in Belz, and recently, when I was at the Holocaust Museum in Washington, D.C., they had a list of all the communities in Eastern Europe which were totally, Jewish communities, which were totally extinguished during the German occupation, and I looked over the list and Belz was included in it. I had never heard much of it, but my dad did mention the name. At any rate, when he lived there in Bessarabia, which was then a province of Russia, he was of course eligible for the Russian draft. His mother died either in childbirth or very, very young. His father died when he was about 8 or 9 years old. He was raised by an older sister. The older sister married, and her husband was a rope maker. My dad then, at age 18, whenever they became eligible for the draft, which I think was 18, he was drafted into the Russian army. And did not like it very much. It was not a very pleasant life for anybody, but for particularly for a Jewish draftee. He, in due time, was shipped out because at that time, which was about 1899 or 1900, there was a lot of friction and preparations were underway for what later became the war between Russia and Japan. And at that time, he was shipped out with a military shipment to Japan in preparation for that war. He already knew that he did not plan to stay in the army the full term. When they passed through the Suez Canal, my dad always had a very hazy idea of geography, but he knew when they passed through the Suez Canal that they were very close to Palestine. And he decided that he was going to jump off the ship as they passed through the canal and make his way to Palestine. The Suez Canal is very narrow and the ship passes very close to the shore, and at night he stood at the bank, at the rail of the ship, and gauged the distance from there to the shore. He could not swim. He had never learned to swim, and he debated long whether he should make the big jump from the railing of the ship onto the shore, and as he used to tell it, he decided that it would take two jumps, and he was not prepared to take that risk of making it in two jumps, and he let it go. Otherwise, I think I would have been telling you this story in Israel instead of in Palestine. He did not jump because, I say, it decided it would have taken two jumps. They went on the next scheduled ship, the next scheduled stop of the ship was at Colombo, which later, the name was later changed to Sri Lankar. It's known as Sri Lankar now. It was in Colombo, and he decided that he was going to jump ship, escape, desert, there in Sri Lankar. Ceylon. It was Ceylon then. And when the ship arrived there, and he had decided he was going to get off there, a quarantine was in effect, and the ship didn't dock, so he couldn't get off there. The ship went on, and it ultimately came to It came to Shanghai. It also went to Tientsin, and I'm not sure whether he deserted at Shanghai or at Tientsin, one or the other. But he had a long series of experiences then, because for the next several months, he lived the life of a refugee, and one step, or sometimes half a step, ahead of the authorities who were after him and other deserters. And if they had been caught, certainly life would not have been very pleasant for him. He had a series of experiences there. One of them, and the one that led to our name. One morning, the authorities rounded up a whole group of, I won't say vagabonds, homeless people who were obviously were refugees, were not established people there, and they lined them up for questioning as to their identity. I think they were Jewish, or they were largely Jewish. While he was waiting in line, wondering what he was going to tell them when they picked him, when they questioned him, a man, this was in Tientsin, I'm quite sure this was in Tientsin, a man, a total stranger, sidled up to him and in a semi-whisper said to him, "Your name is Solomon Cohn. You arrived this morning from Shanghai, second class," and the man disappeared. When my dad came to the head of the line, and they asked him, "Who are you?" And he said, "I am Solomon Cohn. I came this morning from Shanghai, second class." And the man looked up on his official records there, and he saw that that was true, and that Solomon Cohn had arrived that morning from Shanghai, second class. And they told him, "Go on your way." And he kept the name. He gave up the name. The name of Zamapowski disappeared at that moment, and he kept the name. When he came to Seattle, later on, my Aunt Semi, who became my Aunt Semi, was my mother's sister, said, "At least if you're going to have the name Cohn, don't spell it the way everybody else does. Spell it differently. Spell it C-O-N." And so he said, okay, it didn't make any difference to him. And he took that. And that's how we got the name. There were many such stories connected with, including one time when he again was apprehended by the authorities. No, not at all. Another time, my dad also was apprehended by one of the authorities who was identifying strangers, and he managed to convince him that he spoke only Romanian, that he did not speak Russian, and therefore could not be a deserter from the army because he did not even speak Russian. He convinced them that he was a Romanian, that he had lost his passport, and that he was writing home for a copy. That was a consular official. That consular official wrote a letter certifying that my dad was a Romanian citizen, and he lost his passport, and he was writing home for a copy, and it would be back shortly. And my brother has that letter today. My dad kept the letter. And Mort and Fern have that letter now.
We'd like to make a copy of
that. I should do that. I could get that.
Put it in there.
Yeah, I could get that, because little things like that saved his life and probably saved the lives of many other people in similar situations. He could do that because having been raised in a community that was perfectly bilingual, the peasants, the natives, all spoke Romanian, but they had to also speak Russian. So he could speak either language with equal fluency, having been raised in where they spoke both. He finally realized that it was getting too hard to stay there, and he stowed away on a ship. And he really was not sure where the ship was going, but it was coming to Seattle. After the ship had been out for a day or two, he realized that he could not stay stowed away on it for a 3-week trip without food or water or anything. And he gave himself up, and of course they had to feed him, and so on through the rest of the trip. But they kept him detained, and they were going to return him. So he decided that he had to sneak off the ship. It docked in Victoria first, and he tried and tried and could not get off. It was not able to make his way off the ship, so he stayed on. And the next dock was Seattle. And here he managed to sneak his way off. So that's how he arrived in Seattle. He arrived in Seattle knowing no English, and I guess he had some coins. He had some money, which, not a lot, of course, but a little bit, that he was able to make his way a little bit. And he often told the story that he went into a restaurant, sat down at a lunch counter, and listened, and the man next to him ordered hamburger. So he said to the waiter, hamburger, and for the next several days, or I don't know how long, he lived on hamburger, because that was the single word that he knew. In those days, many European, young Russian men were arriving in the city under a variety of circumstances. And my dad heard somebody, either in the restaurant or someplace, he heard a couple of men speaking Yiddish. And of course he was then able immediately to establish identity with them because he could talk to them. And they, one of them, invited him to come up to the shul. That was before Vicar Colum, but there was a shul, because Vicar Colum was already established, I believe, at that time. At any rate, they went to the shul. And as I say, there were many Russian young men arriving. And one of the men there invited him to come to the house for a meal. And that was the man. That man had, and I don't know whether this was by design or not that he invited him to come to the meeting, but that man had five unmarried daughters. And my dad met one of them, and ultimately she was quite popular. That was Rickles. That was Gershon George Rickles. My dad was about 20 or 21 at the time. And going back, well, that's how he arrived here. He met then the Rickles, and I believe his first job here, my uncle, Sam Mosler, owned a bakery. At that time, he already had a bakery. They had been here a number of years before, and he was established. And he had a bakery. And my dad's first job was driving a horse and wagon, delivering bread for my uncle. And the horse's name was Maud. These are things he remembered, and he told me. The horse's name was Maud. He loved that horse. But for some time, that was his job, delivering bread. And then later on, he got started in other businesses, too. Essentially, that's how my dad came here. My mother's family, which I'll just go over rather briefly, because I think it is written down, but I think I'll go over it very briefly. My mother's father, Rickles, George Rickles, came from a close to that area. It was the Ukraine, and it may have been Bessarabia. I believe it was Bessarabia also. Bessarabia had a very big Jewish community. And she tells a story that is really a very painful story. My mother told me this story, and of course it was known in the family. At the time that they were fleeing Russia, it was not legal for them to leave, and they had to hire a smuggler, usually a non-Jewish person.
Do you remember the year?
Just about. It would be about 1887. May have been 6 or 7. I think that I can probably identify it to get that year. They had to hire a smuggler. A goy, to use their expression, somebody who lived around there and who knew the area well, to guide them across a very marshy area at night to get them out of across the border into where Poland or wherever the next country was. I think it was over a river or certainly through a marshy area. My grandmother at that time had an infant child, and going through this marshy area at night, very fearful that the child would cry out and attract the attention of guards and their life would be at risk. She held the baby to her very closely to prevent the baby from crying out at night and giving them away. And she held the baby through her, and the guide who was taking them, the smuggler who was smuggling them across the border, many times they would betray people and take their money and then turn them into the authorities. This man didn't. He was honest and decent, and he successfully guided them across, and they arrived across the river the next morning, and she had held the baby to her so tight that she had smothered the baby, and the baby died. She had 10 children. She had 10 children, and all the other 9 grew to a really long life. They were a long-lived family. My Aunt Esther just died at 101, and my mother was 86, and all of them lived long, except the one who died in infancy under those circumstances. So they then came to this country. They came, and she had, I would have to check, she had 3 or 4. No, she had 5 or 6 children at that time. The last three, I believe, were born in Seattle. I can check on that. P. Allen Rickles, my uncle, and my Aunt Esther, who just, as I say, just died at 101. And P. Allen Rickles were born in Seattle. They came about 1887 or maybe 88. Washington was not yet a state. Washington was still a territory. It was before the fire. And I am not sure exactly what in the world brought them to Seattle. It's a little bit vague. As I understand it, and I think I can check on this, my grandfather, that is my mother's father, had a brother who we never knew very well. It was either a brother or a cousin who had come to this country, also from the same area, of course, and through New York. For some reason, he came to Seattle, and my grandfather and his wife, my grandmother, came to Seattle just because he was there, and he led the way, and they came here. Their first home here was in the Green River Valley on a farm near where Kent or Auburn are now. Maybe near Renton, but it was up the river. And one of my mother's earliest memories, that river used to flood very frequently, high floods. It's with dams, it's under control now, but I remember even as a child when the Green River would have disastrous floods. And one of my mother's earliest memories was of a man carrying her. She was a child, I suppose, maybe 3 or 4 years old at the time. And he put her on his shoulders and he waded across the river. This memory stayed with my mother all the time, wading across the river on this man's shoulder. So that was that would have been about 1890 or early 1890s, 91 or 2, somewhere in there, because she would have been possibly 3 or 4 or 5 years old. They settled. He became a founder of, he was one of the founders of Bicker Colum. He was always active in the community. My grandmother was always active. Both of them were very active in the community. My mother, actually, she was born in Europe, but she came here so young, she was about a year or a year and a half old, that she always felt that she was born in America. To her, she was born in America. She went to school. Went through school, through grammar school. Never went any farther than that because the girls, most did not go through high school, but certainly girls didn't. She started to work a little side library. After I got in the printing business, she was telling me that her first job, one of her first jobs, was for a printing firm in Seattle. And she still remembers this so clearly. They were printing labels. They were printing labels for cans of sand. And her job was to count out. The sheets would come off the press, and she would count them out before they delivered them to the customer. And what she remembers so clearly is that when they were supposed to deliver 1,000 sheets, she was told to count to 950 and deliver that. She was told she always had to deliver the short count. But that's one of the things that stayed in her memory. To go back, to start, I think that an interesting part is the life in Port Angeles. My father was always, he was an adventuresome person and always restless. And he changed businesses a number of times. In 1921, I was 6 years old. I was born in 15. When I was 6 years old, he decided to move to Port Angeles and start a furniture store there. This was pretty far out for a Jewish family here in Seattle, or any place for that matter. So we moved. We moved at that time to Port Angeles, and I started first grade. Well, actually, I had started in first grade in Seattle, but I changed in the middle of the year and finished the first grade in Port Angeles. Port Angeles, you're familiar with where it is. It's up on the Straits, and it's about, at that time, it was about a 6 or 7 hour trip from Seattle. It's faster now, of course. At that time, the town had 10,000 people, and it was a mill town. There were two main mills in the town, Zellerbach paper, they made craft paper, and there was a big plywood mill, Peninsula Plywood, and plywood. And they were the main industries of the town. We moved there, and the town at that time had probably 8 or 10 Jewish families. Saul Levy.
Already living there.
Yes. Well, either they were already there or they came the same time we did as a child. I don't remember specifically whether they were there just before us or just after us. They were there the same time we were. Yes. And I can quickly go over who they were.
Said Saul Levy.
Yeah, Saul Levy, his wife Sadie. They came from England. All my parents' generation who I knew came from Europe, and they came from England. And I was quite impressed with that because I didn't know any Jewish people who spoke with an English accent, and they did, and that was pretty impressive to me. Saul Levy and his wife Sadie, and they had two children, Leon and Sybil. Leon was the same age as me, and we were quite close all the time that we were there. Saul Levy and his brother-in-law, Meyer Cohn, and his wife, Clara, and they had two children, two sons.
What were their occupations?
Yeah, I was just going to come to that. Tell you. They had two sons, Sylvan and Leonard. Leonard became a dentist. Sylvan died some time ago. Leonard became a dentist here in Seattle. They operated, Saul Levy owned and operated, along with Meyer Cohn, two wholesale grocery firms. One was the Commission Company, and one was Cash and Carry. They were both wholesale grocery firms, and rather substantial and successful. And they lived there many years. I think they were there before we were there, and they were there. They remained after we left, but ultimately they moved to Seattle, where Leon became a dentist, and I still see him from time to time. There also was another family, Al Lasky and his wife, Mildred, and their daughter, Sidel. And he operated a tobacco shop, a cigar stand. In those days, the cigar stands were more common than they are now. On the main street downtown on First, near Lincoln Street, and he sold candy and sundries and tobacco, cigars and cigarettes and so on. let's see. There was the Steinberg family, Sam Steinberg and his brother. I think his name was Sam. At any rate, they were two brothers. And they operated a men's clothing store. And they were the only ones who I knew of who were quite observant. And he was observant to the extent that he kept his store closed on Saturday. And I opened on Sunday. And that was a real hardship because it didn't hurt him any, except that business-wise it did, because his customers were mainly loggers who worked out in the camps during the week, and the only time they could come into town was on the weekend. And he was well-known, and he was respected for his integrity and all, but he would not open the store on Saturdays. Now, never my dad talking about it. My dad respected him for it, but he would tell me how people would sometimes even call him at home and plead with him to come and open the store on Saturdays, and he never did. So he was able to maintain that, even in the small town. The rest of the Jewish community were not that observant. There were one or two more people. There was a dentist, Dr. Michelson, and there was a Michelson. And Morris Pearl operated a hotel on the corner of First and Lincoln. And he had a daughter, Molly, who also was about the same age as I was. And there was another family by the name of Shore, and they had two sons. I didn't know them well. They moved away a little earlier. And that was about the whole family, the whole Jewish community at that time. There was no organized Jewish community except that at the holidays, at Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, the small group of people, as small as they were, would hold services. The services were held in the Moose Hall, Moose Temple, Moose Hall, on 6th and Lincoln. That building is not there anymore. None of these buildings are there anymore. But it was at that time, it was. And they would hold services all day on Yom Kippur, which was a real drag to us as children. But we did not stay there all day. But we were supposed to put in an appearance, at least. But then, let's see, I said we moved there in 1921, which we did, and we were there until 1925. And we moved back to Seattle, and we were in Seattle until 1928. My dad had sold the business, but the person he bought it from was not successful with it.
You were in Port Angeles?
Port Angeles.
Yeah, you said Seattle.
Oh, I'm sorry. Well, we came back from Port Angeles to Seattle in 1925 because my father had sold the business in Port Angeles. We stayed here for 3 years. We lived here for 3 years on 31st Avenue, 538 31st Avenue. I forgot to tell you that our address in Port Angeles was 125 East 8th Street.
Okay.
I'm sure you'll be interested. Oh, it was on the corner of 8th and Lincoln. Not only is the house not there, the whole area is not there anymore. Or scarcely, it's changed a lot. Let's see, we came back to Seattle in 1938.
Before you get back get back to Seattle, did you have any experiences with anti-Semitism, you or your family?
Anti-Semitism was not bad, but it was present. I say present.
What form?
You knew you were Jewish because other kids would sometimes make a remark or an observation about a Jewish. It was not bad. My dad and the other Jewish people operated businesses successfully. If there had been real anti-Semitism, I mean serious anti-Semitism, it would have interfered with their business. We never had anything like that. On the other hand, I would certainly say that it was known. Kids would make remarks, not viciously. I think they would be repeating things they heard at home. Snide remarks or contemptuous remarks, but not vicious. It never bothered me, and I don't think bothered anybody seriously. Nevertheless, I would have to say certainly it was present. We were not excluded from anything. not from any, Sol Levy was a very active community-minded person. And one of the things that he did, he founded the first Cub Scout pack or troop in the United States. He had gone to Victoria and he had knew somebody who, there was a Cub Scout, the Cub movement was just beginning then. And he founded the first pack in the United States, which was in Port Angeles. And I, of course, Leon and I were both members of it. So there was nothing, there were any organization that there was there, we were part of. We were not excluded from anything. On the other hand, if we had wanted to join the golf club there, I don't know whether we would have been excluded. That never would have occurred in 100 years, so I don't know. But there might have been some exclusion there, but there was never anything.
Nothing hurtful.
No, nothing hurtful other than an occasional remark, which is kind of hurtful, but not seriously, nothing that I have any.